So we are using as a sort of backdrop for this for talks, Love Thy Body by Nancy Pearcey, who in much more detail than I will talks about the idea of the self being separated from the body and all the implications of that. She roots it in Greek and Roman philosophy and then kind of brings it up to date. Well, tonight we're going to do the same thing, but we're going to apply it to gender and sexuality, and then next week we're going to apply it to the general culture of not so much sexual perversion, but sexual license and the whole kind of hookup culture and everything, because I think it does connect very well with that. And some really interesting things to say, I think, studies that have been done and stuff we're going to look at next week. But this week we're going to think about gender and sexuality, or more like sexuality first and then gender. So it'd be really good to have a Bible or have an electronic version of the Bible and have a quick look at Romans 1, 18 to 32. So unlike last week, this is a straight in with a kind of interact a little bit. Have a look. It's a pretty famous passage, Romans 1, 18 to 32. The wrath of God is being revealed from heaven against all the godlessness and wickedness of people who suppress the truth by their wickedness, since what may be known about God is plain to them because God has made it plain to them. For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that people are without excuse. For although they knew God, they neither glorified him as God nor gave thanks to him. But their thinking became futile and their foolish hearts were darkened. Although they claimed to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images made to look like a mortal human being and birds and animals and reptiles. Therefore, God gave them over in the sinful desires of their hearts to sexual impurity for the degrading of their bodies with one another. They exchanged the truth about God for a lie, and worshipped and served the created things rather than the Creator, who is forever praised. Because of this, God gave them over to shameful lusts. Even their women exchanged natural sexual relations for unnatural ones. In the same way, the men also abandoned natural relations with women and were inflamed with lust for one another. Men committed shameful acts with other men and received in themselves the due penalty for their error. Furthermore, just as they did not think it well to retain the knowledge of God, so God gave them over to a depraved mind, so that they do what ought not to be done. They have become filled with every kind of wickedness, evil, greed, and depravity. They are full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, and malice. They are gossips, slanderers, God-haters, insolent, arrogant, and boastful. They invent ways of doing evil. They disobey their parents. They have no understanding, no fidelity, no love, no mercy. Although they know God's righteous decrees that those who do such things deserve death, they not only continue to do these things, but also approve of those who practice them. So, if you look at the kind of process here, how does it all begin? Tell me about the revelation of God.
Reveals his wrath.
He's revealing his wrath, absolutely. He's revealing his wrath because of what other revelation of God?
They forgot him as creator.
They forgot him as creator. Why should they have known he was the creator?
His invisible qualities.
Because of the beauty around him.
Yeah, because of... Well, it doesn't mention beauty, but it says... it's fair enough, because something in the whole of creation is expressing the truth of a transcendent God. And you can argue that emotionally, or you can argue that... what's the word? Logically. That there has to be a transcendent... There's a revelation for God in creation. So what did we do with that revelation? Where did it kind of all begin? The word that's quite familiar to us, beginning with I.
What?
A word quite familiar to us in Christian circles, idolatry. So, where are you going like...
I didn't even hear the question.
Oh, okay. You gave the right answer, though. Okay, so it turned into idolatry. That's part of the progress. And then how does it connect that up with sexual immorality? How do they all join up? Try and sort of make them all join up in some way. They gave up on God.
So they gave in to their
Yeah, gave them over to their sinful desires. What happened to their minds because they'd given up on God?
They became fools
because they're suppressing the knowledge of God. So they're suppressing the knowledge of God. They're worshipping idols. God gives them over to what?
Themselves.
Yeah. Yeah, their own desires. And how does that connect with the body and nature and non-nature? How does Paul describe it, which is really interesting?
Degrading of their bodies of one another.
They did. He did give them over to shameful lusts. Think about natural, unnatural. How does Paul describe what's going on? Does he describe it as natural or unnatural?
Unnatural.
He describes it as unnatural. Now, don't you think that's interesting? I think that's interesting.
Yeah.
Because he's used... Yeah?
This may be a really silly question. Who's he talking... Who's Paul talking to?
That's not a silly question. That's a good question. I thought just now I should have contacted it a bit more.
You don't know who...
I think he's doing an overview of the progress of sin in the world up to that point. In sort of a big picture, to kind of...
Is this a letter?
Yeah, it's a letter that is... It's a letter written to Christians in Rome, who are a mixture of Jews and Gentiles. And it's quite a famous letter because it's a big statement that leads to understanding justification by faith.
But he's talking about just what he's seen in the world.
Yeah, but it's slightly poetic in a way, but he's like painting it as though it's a picture of the progress of sin that sort of starts and gets to this point. So he's kind of making it in, obviously, life's more complicated in an individual's life, but he's looking at the progress of humanity in general since creation and sort of mapping it through it and sort of drawing a really big picture of it and saying, in general, what's happened is we've become idolatrous because we've suppressed the knowledge of God, and so God gives us over to do what we want to do, which is unnatural. The interesting thing, I think, is that he doesn't even talk about the command here so much, does he? He just talks about suppressing the knowledge of God. So obviously, the knowledge of God means you suppress the revelation from God, which includes the command. But very interestingly, he talks about nature. Like, what's happening is unnatural. Which I think is really important and not very much emphasised. I know I've talked to one or two of you about this before, but it's a kind of a recent thing that I've kind of thought about more, about the natural argument as well as the kind of command argument. And... what I think he mentions bodies, I just can't remember off the top of my head. It's dishonouring the body. Where's the phrase dishonouring the body?
Degrading of their bodies.
Degrading of their bodies, yeah. Verse which, sorry?
24.
Thank you. Yeah. Verse 24. God gave them over to the sinful desires of their hearts to sexual immorality for the degrading of their bodies with one another. Again, what's really interesting is that he talks about the degrading of their bodies, not just the sort of breaking of a command, or the problem with their hearts. Because the Bible does talk a lot about heart sins. So, obviously there's a heart element involved because they suppress the knowledge of God and worship idols. But there's a body element involved. So he's saying they're actually degrading their bodies. And I just kind of point that out because it supports all we've been looking at so far, which is the Bible has a high view of the body as well as of the soul. And what we do with our bodies matters. So Paul in... Corinthians, or maybe Romans, I can't remember, talks about, basically, they should stop going to prostitutes, because when you sleep with a prostitute, you become united with her. And it's not like he says, well, as long as your heart wasn't in it, it doesn't matter. If it was just a functional thing and not a heart thing, that was okay. He does think it matters what you do with your body, because of course it says something about your heart as well, but it also is something to be preserved or not preserved, if that makes sense. So I want to get to some of the pastoral questions a bit quicker this evening.
Greg, can I ask what it means in the end of verse 27, men committed indecent acts with other men and received in themselves the due penalty for their perversion?
It's a really interesting question. Some people think it's just the sort of moral penalty of the sort of collapse of society. It may be that statistically, it's certainly true, you get more ill if you're homosexual. You get more, particularly with less medicine and hygiene and everything else, because it's basically a, a antibody function, not antibody, a body function against the body function. You know, it's a, it's not a natural thing. Yeah.
A Roman version of AIDS.
Quite possibly, but I think, but I just think in general, he just may be referring to that, but it may be just the moral consequences of, you know, the breakdown of society. But it may be, yeah.
But your depravity would certainly get worse.
Yeah, yeah.
That's out of the drug, so I'm sure people must feel that.
Yeah, possibly. Although it depends how they filter their experiences, which we'll think about in a minute. Because if they filter it through a moral framework that says it's okay, they may be allowed to feel okay about themselves, even though what they're doing with their bodies is not right. Okay, so important thing to note from that is it's idolatry, it's about the suppression of the knowledge of God, it's outworked in degrading our bodies, in doing what is unnatural, and speaking about natural and unnatural is part of the kind of narrative. Okay, so very quickly, the rest of the biblical framework, which is partly a repeat of what we've already thought about other weeks, but I just want to keep underlining it. So, biblical framework, big picture, is that God made male and female. That's defined at creation. Male and female, he created them. And that is there in Genesis 1 and 2. And, again, we're not going to drill down into great detail, but equipped for different roles. So, male and female made different, more different in terms of their role than in terms of any particular characteristic. I said not sewing because...
Not sewing.
I said e.g. sewing, yes. That this was an example of... And it's an important thing to think about because if you find a man who likes sewing, you don't say that's very feminine. Is there anything in the Bible that defines sewing as a feminine activity? Not really. Quite so. So, but it's just, I was just trying to find a quick way of illustrating the fact that actually it plays into the whole gender characteristics narrative that says, okay, so if you've got a, what was that? Probably the light.
Fly.
Or a fly. It'll be dead soon.
Men made the tabernacles and the fabric stuff that went with that was sort of sewing.
Yeah, well, certainly that sewing would be an example of that. But also, in the most of the culture that Jesus wrote to the Old Testament was born up in, you know, women and men were working in the fields and so forth. Mm-hmm. You know, Ruth's working in the fields. So you can very easily have a sort of gender stereotype that doesn't really work. But there is a lot of teaching in the Bible about being equipped for different roles. But you just need to make sure you don't kind of be simplistic about that. Marriage itself is defined at creation and then reiterated at various points in the Old Testament, and all sex outside of marriage is condemned in the rest of the Old Testament. It's condemned again in the New Testament. There's a transforming sexual ethic in the New Testament, which completely transforms society, which is basically sexually immoral, the society that that Paul writes into. There is, and it's disastrous generally. Quite so. Polygamy being having more than one wife.
When is like the first bit in the Bible that says not to do that?
That's a really good question. I think Genesis 1, 25, whatever it is, gives sufficient. So right at the beginning of Genesis 1, I think that gives sufficient because it talks about when a man, you know, leaves his wife and cleaves to his whatever, husband. A man leaves his wife and cleaves to his wife. A man leaves his family and cleaves to his wife. Oh, it's good. I'm mixing translations, words, and everything else. And it says there in Genesis 1, and the two will become one flesh. So I think it's strongly implied in Genesis 1. I'm kind of racking my brains, but I think probably the first time that it's kind of assumed when you get to the Ten Commandments, but it's, you know, because there must be an assumption that adultery is an understood concept when it says in Exodus 20, you shall not commit adultery. And it's kind of assumed, although blurred a bit in some of the Old Testament stories, you know, as you would know from, you know, thinking about Abraham or some of the others and some of the rough things they got up to. But it's never said to be a good thing. And the commandment sits there as in contrast to the nations around them, being husband of one wife, and is kind of roundly condemned in the rest of the Old Testament. And then particularly reinforced and made really, really clear in the New Testament. Is that okay? One man, one woman in this exclusive lifelong relationship is what God's plan is. And then, this is all familiar to you, so I'm going fast. Marriage reflecting Christ in the church as his redeemed people. And as we looked at in Romans already, going against this plan is actually dishonouring our bodies, as well as it is breaking up all those other things. The Old Testament teaching is reiterated in the New Testament, so all sex outside the covenant of marriage between a man and woman goes against God's plan. And all of that means that when we make decisions about having sex with somebody, we're not just breaking a command, which is bad enough, we're actually going against a kind of a fundamental design of the universe that God has built in. And actually built into the pattern of everything. I think there's a sense in which male and femaleness across the whole of creation, finding its kind of a pinnacle in a sense in humanity. All of that, I think, to some degree is reflecting the character of God. You've got to ask yourself a question. Okay, so if God made men and women to reflect something of Christ and the church as they marry, why didn't he make the rest of creation androgynous? Is that the right word? Asexual, and they all kind of, you know, just all multiplication just happens by some other, you know, why is there a whole kind of a whole complementary process going on and lots of other things that kind of balance each other in nature? I think it's part of the sort of creative design of God, that he's kind of expressing himself in the whole of creation. I think it's rather exciting. You look almost excited about it, but I think it's rather fun to think of that. Did that make sense?
Yeah.
Good. Biblical frameworks, and we're going to think about homosexuality, and I really do think we're going to have a little bit of time. Let's think about homosexuality in the context of both God's plan, but also the cultural narrative about self. And I think it's a combination of once you get the giggles, it's very difficult. Do you want to go and get another biscuit or something, you know? So it's a combination of postmodern thinking and this idea of the self that we've been looking at already. So just to help me out, tell me how you think those things connect up, particularly what we've been looking at to do with the self the last few weeks and homosexuality. How do you think those two connect up? All this personhood theory stuff we've been doing.
Feel, you know, you think is right.
Yes.
So your desires and feelings, you just go with your feelings. And so if you feel like you're, you know, attracted to the same sex.
Yes.
Then you just go with that because you feel it's right.
Yes, absolutely.
Right, you feel that way.
Yes, yeah. And it's quite helpful to kind of root it in that personhood idea that the person is separate from the body. What is also quite interesting culturally is that is much more the narrative than for a little while. I remember when I was in my 20s and 30s, maybe, I was just working, so maybe I was in the 30s, and there was some little sort of studies that maybe showed there could be some genetic reason. Do you remember there was some publicity about the gay gene?
Yes.
Well, yeah, particularly about whether there was a sort of... A genetic reason for being same-sex attracted. most of that has just collapsed. There's been lots of twin studies done and various other things that don't really support that. So the narrative now is not so much that you're born gay, although that sometimes gets used as an argument. Actually, those who study it would not say that. Even Peter Tatchell, who's kind of, you know, very famous gay rights campaigner, would not say... it's a matter of some genetic programming. He would actually say it's a combination, a bit like I've said in the notes there, a little bit later on, that it's a combination. As it says in bullet point 3-4, no evidence anyone was born that way, but even if there was, it doesn't make it inevitable. Most agree possibly genetic predisposition coupled with environmental influences and habitual practices, neuroplasticity, e.g. pornographic responses. Now, you've got to make some sense of that now. So most people would say that if you're a practicing homosexual, if you're practicing homosexual, it's a combination of that there may well be a, not so much a gay gene, but a combination of genetic influences that may make you a bit more predisposed than others. So you've got that going on. You've got a whole load of environmental factors, which could be all kinds of experiences. It may be the sort of rather cliched absent father, dominant mother, but there's a whole load of other influences as well that may be happening. But a third factor, which is also recognised, is habit. That actually, a lot of our, so I've got to say sex a lot this evening, a lot of our sexual responses are partly habitual as well as kind of instinctive and natural. So a lot of it is to do with kind of walking the same paths. And the neuroplasticity thing is just making the point. There's been lots of studies done with to do with pornography, which is basically saying if you watch enough pornography, your brain changes. That's what it basically says. It's pretty well proven. It's true also of gambling and various other things, that if you simulate in a particular direction, you know, whether good or bad, it will to some degree change your brain, which will change some of your reflexes. And so that's called neuroplasticity.
Which also, what do you mean? Like if you watch a lot of pornography, then you're going to want to have sex more?
No, if you watch a lot of pornography, it will start to kind of orientate your brain around wanting more of that. But it's more to the point that it's actually physically changed your brain. So it's kind of, yeah, it programs an addiction. It wires up a whole load of shortcuts for you. So you see that as a kind of as a good thing that you keep going for. And because of that, I think so. I'm sure you can long-term unravel it in the same way that you've raveled it, but, it's more the point that habits do for a moon. It's the same thing to say that if you, well, I've just put a new cover on my phone, which is white now, on the front, and it used to be silver, gold, sorry. Well, it is gold underneath. I still look at my phone and think it's not my phone, because you do lots of brain shortcuts that just glance and see your phone. You don't look at it and say, it's gold, it's my phone. You glance it and grab it. You walk into the room and you know where the light switch is. If you move the light switch, it takes you about a week to work out where it is. And that's a bit of brain reprogramming that's going on. That happens in big moral decisions you make as well. That's all interesting. Yeah. I'm not sure if being a Christian changes your brain. I think that your brain is a receptacle for, it's a mediator for your heart, as it were, for your soul, your soul and affections. So, I'm sure there's chemical changes that reorientate the things that you like, because you train yourself to like them in a way. Mm-hmm. So I think there probably is chemical changes. In fact, there is, actually, it talks about them in the book, about stimulation. It makes the point, actually. That's a very good question. I remember now. It talks about monks and nuns. And it says that studies of monks and nuns show that their brains light up with kind of certain chanting that they've got used to in the nunnery. What do you call a place where... Convent. Yeah, convent, thank you. But where do monks go?
Monasteries.
Oh, you guys are so well educated.
Is there such a thing as a nunnery? Yeah, there is, but...
No. A nunnery, it's like a cattery where you keep cats. It's where you put your nuns when you go on holiday. It's called a nunnery. And a monkery is where you put... I'm getting into this now. So anyway, they've done studies that show certain parts of the brain light up when you chant things. And the point in the book is actually to say that that is a learned thing. It's not making a moral statement about whether that inevitably should happen. It's just you can train yourself to do things that are good and to, in a sense, respond to things that are good, or you can train yourself to respond to things that are bad. The fact that you respond to them is not a moral statement about whether they're good or bad. The fact that a part of the brain is stimulated by the nuns chanting is just because it's a learned habit. It's not because it's morally good or morally bad. You have to use different criteria. That was a good question, Mia, because that drew that little bit of information out of me.
So that could be the same for mental health as well. I'm not, it's just totally different, but I realise this. But mental health in the fact that certain things trigger certain pathways that, you know, like, say, introspection, for example.
Yes.
And the way that you think. If you do that enough, then it's quite easy to go down those
same
pathways that are not necessarily always good.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, I'm sure that's true.
It's always a choice.
There is also always a choice.
Always a choice.
Yeah, but the choices get easier if you have less habit.
Yeah, but it's still a choice.
Sure, because sure.
You weaken yourself and you use that as an excuse.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's still a choice.
It is, yeah. Yeah, it is. All of this started with saying, what are the causes that people become homosexual, practicing homosexuals? I think they're that combination of genetics, what did I say the middle one was? Maybe some genetic predisposition, environment, and habit. And if you... Pardon? It doesn't agree with the genetic bit. I don't care. As in, I do care whether you agree or not. What I mean is, I don't care is that I'm not making a very strong point for the genetic predisposition. Some people argue for it, some people think there isn't. There's no proof of any specific genetic cause. There's some discussion about whether some people are possibly genetically more predisposed. Predisposed is different to being determined.
Do you think the way children are brought up could be an influence?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Interesting thing, at the end of that bullet point, and again, it's rather compressed language, so I'll hopefully make sense. The strongest correlation with same-sex eroticism is not a genetic or a physical trait, but behaving like other children in childhood. So here's the thing. In studies they've done, the people who end up as practicing homosexuals correlate most with people who have acted out a lot, like excessively, different roles, different gender roles in childhood, in a sort of big way, not just in like a bloke who dresses up in a skirt once, behaving like the other gender in childhood perpetually through childhood is the most likely correlation. So in all the studies they've done, it doesn't correlate with some genetic common thing, doesn't even correlate with always sort of absent father, dominant mother thing. It correlates much more with that.
Do you mean like a girl being a tomboy?
Yeah, no, see, that's where you get into sort of too many gender stereotyping, but because many girls who are tomboyish can end up, but I think acting out, being a tomboy is being a girl who likes climbing trees and doesn't like having dolls. I think the dressing is beginning when you're actively, rather than just saying I like wearing this, when you're sort of actively saying I want to wear, and particularly in younger age, or whether in role play you always want to be the woman. That's the most likely correlation. I'm not saying that's necessarily a cause, but that's just apparently. I don't want you to get all worried who've got children and all the rest of it, that sort of panic, but I'm just saying what it says. Yes, and that's a good thing. Yes, indeed. How's that going for you? Also, as it says there, lots of recent studies have shown that there's much less, it's much less fixed than people used to think as well. There's a lot of fluidity. That's probably more proven amongst women than amongst men, but it's also proven amongst men. So although, just as a connected point, I think it's unwise for Christians to sort of make a big thing about gay conversion therapy for all kinds of reasons about our use of language, I think we shouldn't just accept that it's completely fixed. Even non-Christian people would say that it's fluid. But there's some arguments about how fluid it is. But there are many, particularly lesbians, who seem to be more straightforward and honest about it, or just maybe it's just how women are, but loads of lesbians who have no interest in the Christian faith would say it's absolutely a choice. They would say it's a choice I want to make, and that's fine, because I want to make a choice to be a lesbian, but it's completely a choice. It's not inevitable, they would say, lots of them. And lots of studies would back that up as well. These are all good things to say. I'm not saying you need to argue for them, but they're just good things to kind of have if you're talking around the subject.
Often, I think there can be many external influences, well, as you say, anxiety,
sure, yeah,
where the opposite sex has done something,
yeah,
that has been very upsetting, and therefore your attraction is to your own sex.
Yeah, it's very interesting. Who's the... who's the lady who's Conservative leader in Scotland?
Nicola
Sturgeon.
Ruth Davis.
No, sorry. Ruth Davis, Conservative. Sorry, Nicola Sturgeon is the overall leader. The, pardon?
She was on the scene being interviewed this evening.
Wow. She gave a very interesting interview, maybe it was the same one tonight, but a couple of weeks ago, about herself. And something happened to her in her early life. And also she had lots of mental health issues, lots of self-harm issues. She went back to church. She's famously a lesbian, so that's why I was using her example. But it was kind of interesting, not to say, oh, let's put her in a box, she's a you know, nutcase. But it was kind of interesting to think, I wonder what all the environmental factors that led her to where she is. Quite happy with where she is, so that's hard to dislodge now, if you imagine where she's got to, just saying to her, you know, you're not. But I'm sure there was loads of environmental factors that led her to that. It sounded like she was abused or harmed or had some really difficult upbringing thing that happened to her, from what she kind of hinted at. So anyway, those are some of the sort of the kind of how you get there things. What the cultural narrative now is that a gay person is, and particularly one who's acting out their desire by either having a number of partners or having a kind of lifelong partner that they marry, is that the narrative is they've discovered their authentic self, and our culture would say that you have to express that authentic self. It's almost a moral imperative. It's almost immoral if you don't, and it's certainly immoral if you ask someone not to express their authentic self. And again, the narrative is that people will be most happy and fulfilled by being who they are. And along with that, that our flesh, it's the same to do with transgender as well, but it also works with homosexuality, that our flesh, that our body is kind of randomly assigned at birth, and then what really matters is the kind of self inside and what it wants. What is interesting is that's very modern. Lots of things you could say are kind of historic, and some of the philosophy, the self philosophy, is not modern at all. But the idea of identity is actually very new. What was again interesting in the book to read, if you get around to reading it, is a kind of detailed explanation of homosexuality in Greek-Roman culture, which is that it was never considered an identity. It was just considered something that you did, and something that in a society that had kind of become morally completely unravelled was an option amongst a number of options. So many people would have wives for children, they would have male and female prostitutes, or female and male prostitutes if you're a man, sex slaves of various gender, and just have a whole sort of smorgasbord of sexual options. But it was never considered that one in particular was your sort of destiny. That's a very modern idea.
Like bisexual.
Yeah, basically. Yeah. Well, yeah, but in a cruder sense, it's really just sex that is completely undirected. And that it kind of that loses its anchor in any kind of moral framework. And of course, it kind of goes wherever it wants. And, you know, it's not sort of too crude to say that you can get stimulated by a piece of fruit if you eventually sort of, you know, just allow yourself completely unravel in kind of, you know, where your brain goes and everything else. And that's kind of what it is. And in the past, it would just be considered what you did. It's more modern to actually kind of considering it who you are. The other thing particularly to do with male-on-male sex is that it was kind of known that it was degrading, which is perhaps why Paul uses that expression, that in a way it was a way of dominating, you know, your slaves and so forth, because they would take the part of the woman. It was considered in that culture a dishonourable thing. Whereas now it's considered some kind of sort of liberating thing. So, enough in terms of the background of homosexuality, is that said? Christian responses. I think this and the next topic is probably the hardest, most challenging thing that we will need to talk about. I think when, you know, if I'm interviewed on the radio about abortion, I feel totally confident that there's nothing that anyone can say that I'm sure it's not true, because it's me being proud. But you know what I mean. I don't feel so worried that, because I think it's a straightforward argument. You can agree, disagree. It should be in a way to do with homosexuality and transgender, but it's such a sensitive issue in our culture, because of this elevation of the self, it's really hard to give a Christian response.
Yeah, I mean, particularly when you've got such great support for it amongst the Anglican Church.
Well, yeah, quite so. Yeah, the church being divided on it is a real issue that doesn't help at all. But it does mean that we have to choose our words really carefully. So here's a few things to think about, and then there's two questions at the bottom to ask you to kind of chip in and think about. So things that we might want to say is that God commands and promises to bless sex and marriage as he intended. I think talking about both the command of God and the blessing of God, the goodness of God, is always worth doing. Rather than saying homosexuality is wrong because God says it's wrong, I think we should always be saying as well, God promises to bless living out in his world, his way of men and women marrying, having sex within that marriage, producing children from that, enjoying all the good things that God has given us. That's God's plan, and it's a good thing, and that's where God blesses. And whenever we break out of that, and whenever cultures break out of that, eventually those cultures fall apart. I think that's things more than it's wrong because God says it's wrong. I think, because of what we were saying from Romans, I think it is worth thinking about, but it's really, really hard to have this conversation, particularly with someone who is attracted to people of the same sex. But I think it is a valid point to say that our bodies are designed to reflect God's plan for marriage. So it's not as though God says men and women should marry, but we're all kind of the same. It's not like he gives us a vague hint that men and women are supposed to have sex. It's like so built into the design. It's not subtle, you know, it's not hidden, it's so built into the design. Male and female bodies are clearly designed to fit together in sexual intercourse. That's reflected through a lot of nature as well. And male and female sex is clearly designed as the normal way to produce children. So, how does God say he's going to bless the world? By marriage unions, becoming one flesh, living together, having sexual intercourse, and from that, the world being populated as well. That's where God promises to bless, and nowhere else in terms of that one flesh union. And he's built and designed the models of men and women to completely work with that, with both having sex and having children, and nurturing children. So those are the first kind of three little sub-bullet points there. So it has to follow that homosexuality both breaks the command of God, but also breaks out of the design of God. And we create a new morality. I think I forgot to say it, but I think it's Tim Keller who... Let me just see if I can get the example right. So you're... you're a Viking, and you go around. Your desire is to go around killing people as you conquer England or something like that. But you're heterosexual and you're a manly man, and in the cultural grid of that time, that's completely acceptable. If you were a man who did all the murdery stuff but wanted to sleep with other men, in that kind of Viking cultural framework, you would be considered a bit weird and need some therapy. And Tim Keller does this thought exercise to say it's all because of the moral grid that you're filtering that through. So you take it up to now. So the guy who goes marauding around Hayward's Heath killing people but who thinks homosexuality is wrong, who thinks homosexuality is okay, he has to go to therapy for his going around and killing people and being angry and all that sort of thing. Now, the point is this, that it's all to do with the moral framework. So our moral framework now is that all of those things are, or the transgender, homosexuality and abortion, all those other things are okay. So the whole culture is telling you it's okay, so eventually that becomes the moral grid through which you filter everything. Why is that an issue? Because when Christians say anything about homosexuality or transgender, they're almost like this primitive Viking who is going around killing people, because in the moral framework we have now, we think as Christians that will be wrong, going around killing people, but we now think it's some primitive, out of date, immoral behaviour, because our moral framework now says that's wrong. And that's the really hard thing in talking about this, because it's not a logical, reasonable argument, it's a moral argument, and we're on the wrong side of the moral argument. So we have to try and recover the moral ground as well. Sorry.
Could you be prosecuted for saying something? Has it got that
far yet? Yeah, possibly. It depends on what context. You can certainly be sacked for saying something. Taken off. I mean, there are cases of people who've been prosecuted for saying things.
Yeah.
Because
it just shows how far it's come in a few decades.
Oh, yeah.
Also,
yeah.
1940s, 50s, people were locked up for being homosexual in this country.
Yes.
And now we're so far the other way.
Yeah.
And we get locked up for, complaining about homosexuality.
Yes. Yeah. We can't complain because we are where we are. So what we've got to do though is think into the morality and the goodness of God arguments, rather than just saying it's wrong, because no one will hear this, because the moral grid they're filtering it through is a distorted moral grid, but it's very powerful. So it's trying to find ways in that talk about the goodness of God in His design and His commands, and try and explain our moral framework, try and explain why we think God is good in what He's decreed, and try and talk about our stories that illustrate that, you know, that the blessing of God that we might have known. That's why stories of people who for all those kind of habitual, possibly genetic, possibly environmental reasons, end up being same-sex attracted but are seeking to honour God are great stories which seek to move the kind of, seek to sort of challenge and rattle people's moral framework, as well as, of course, the Word of God. Okay, so tell me, I need your help now in making the arguments, I've just made a few. So to do with homosexuality, before we look at transgender, what are the common biblical objections? So if someone is a sort of half knowledgeable biblical person. What are some common...
I was going to say about David and Jonathan.
Okay, so what's the answer to that?
Well, that they love each other as brothers.
Sure.
Nothing sexual.
No? Yes?
The Old Testament and New Testament are quite very strong worded on the subject, aren't they?
Sure. But I want to know what the counter-biblical arguments are, like the one Mia just said.
Sodom and Gomorrah?
That would be an argument of... people might argue Sodom and Gomorrah was an example of...
not welcoming.
Either not welcoming or of some kind of exploiting sex or something.
So Jesus and John is one.
Okay, yeah. So then what would you say to that?
Again, Jesus loved him in a different way to what your friend.
Yeah?
And John loved Jesus.
Okay, Old Testament arguments?
Wait, what? Talking about John and Jesus? Do people actually say that there was some gay couple?
Yeah.
A virgin.
But then they also say that Jesus and Mary Magdalene as well, so...
Yeah, there's a whole gay narrative to do with Jesus on the cross as well, which is indeed.
Really? Yeah. Where? Who says this?
People.
Oh, Will.
Yeah, talk to him. I want the classic Old Testament argument. The classic. I've heard John Humphreys make it before now.
Steve, or was it?
No.
Eve?
No, that's not that one. That one as well, but the. Okay, so you're on Radio 4 and Leviticus, and you say, you know, it's condemned, and...
Oh, because it's in the same list as, like...
Prawns. Okay. This is a classic argument. Now, you can just demolish it saying, well, who cares, it's reiterating the New Testament, but what else might you say? You've got the whole of the Old Testament law, and in that law, you've got the Ten Commandments, you've got stuff about murdering... and manslaughter, and you've got stuff about prawns and the threading clothes.
So, could you say, obviously, the New Testament still argues against homosexuality, but it's allowed for...
Yes? Yeah?
Oh. It does.
I don't know what you're there's a thing about...
Right, in the Old Testament law... in the Old Testament law, there's a whole load of regulations that include the food you eat and the clothes you wear. No. Yes.
From God.
Yes. 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 Quite so.
Where is this in the
Leviticus? It's in Leviticus. Some of it's in Exodus. Some of it's repeated in Deuteronomy. It's not about prawns predominantly. This is probably one verse about prawns. So, but people sometimes give that as a sort of simplistic example.
So you're saying now what are the arguments?
The arguments back are, well, you know.
To Jesus.
Yeah, and we don't stone adulterers either.
No.
So what are you going to say? So what are you going to say?
You're going to say that...
Some of the Old Testament, we don't actually listen to.
We just pick and choose what we fancy from the Bible. That's the answer.
Well, no, don't we have to get rid of all that stuff because Jesus came?
Yeah. Yes, but did you get rid of all of it?
No.
So what bits remain? That's almost a good answer. It's a pretty good answer. But the categories that we often use are moral, ceremonial, civil. They're quite helpful. They're not actually used in the Bible, but they're quite helpful ideas to think. In the Old Testament, you've got moral law that precedes the Ten Commandments. So that's why I think, you know, not murdering is there to do with Noah. It's before the Ten Commandments. So I think the fundamentals that are summarised in the Ten Commandments actually... are there before, and they're written on our hearts, and they're moral things that continue. And there's a special place for the Ten Commandments as compared to the rest of the stuff, because the Ten Commandments are actually called the Covenant, not all the other stuff, the Ten Commandments. So there's moral stuff, and as Amy said, pretty much it's all repeated by Jesus or the apostles in the New Testament. So that's the moral law. Then there's the ceremonial law. So what was that doing? And why is it superseded?
Sacrifices.
Sorry?
Jesus on the cross?
Yeah, it's symbolising either Jesus on the cross or the whole process of worship or those kind of things. So it's ceremonially symbolising worship, sacrifice, cleanliness, holiness, all those kind of things. So that is done away with in the coming of Jesus. Then you've got the civil law, which is how Israel administrates itself, how you make laws in Israel. And we're no longer a country under God, are we? We're a kingdom under Jesus Christ. So we don't have civil regulations. We've got the moral commands of God, and in as much as we can influence society, we try and make laws that reflect that. But we haven't got from God a whole law about how we organise society and, you know, what the punishment is for speeding over 35 miles an hour. That's no longer regulated by God, because we're not a theocracy anymore. So I mean, that's the answer. But I mean, if you're on Radio 4 2 minutes, you haven't got time to do that. But yeah, I suppose the short answer is. I think the short answer is that that command is part of the moral law, which continues and is reiterated in the New Testament. I think that's probably the simple way of answering it. Should have just said that, really, shouldn't I? But it's useful to get the other stuff. So there's some common biblical a common New Testament biblical objection.
Is your culture to their time?
Culture to their time, or. There's a sort of more sophisticated, well, not that one sophisticated, but you know what I mean.
<There's> basic.
There's a suggestion that a particular homosexual practice is being talked about, not lovey-dovey homosexuality, but another kind of homosexuality. Okay, the suggestion, and it's a very common suggestion by what you might call liberal Christians, is that the homosexuality condemned in the Bible, Old Testament and New Testament, is shrine prostitution, exploitation of slaves. That's the only thing.
If it's like long-term relationship.
Yeah.
If it's too committed.
Yeah. I'm just saying that's the argument that's used. Yeah. So, and your counter-argument, you need a bit of Bible study to do that, but to look at the words used, and you can easily find commentaries to help you with this, but the words used are entirely about same-sex, lying with a man as with a woman. It's not anything to do with shrine prostitution or exploitation or any of those things. All the language used, and particularly if you take the kind of Romans passage, has nothing to do with that. It's to do with people giving themselves over to their sexual desires. So there is an argument back for that, but that's the argument that's made. Okay. Common secular objections? Yeah? Prehistoric thinking? Might be, yeah? So what are you going to say? Okay, so if someone says love is love. Love is love. That was the big thing when... when gay marriage passed in Australia. Oh no, somewhere else. There's a big...
So the whole thing about following your feelings.
Yeah.
Or loving.
Yeah, so someone would just say love is love. That is a nice little neat summary. So love is love between any two people. They can do what they want.
Okay, so
That's sometimes a counter argument.
You know, he's in love with a 10-year-old girl.
Yeah, but that's obviously wrong. I could answer, but it's okay if we're both adults. So there's no exploitation going on, and here am I, and I love this person. Love is love.
Well, I guess it just goes. I don't think you'll think about the whole fact that you're following your heart, aren't you? So you know, you're just going to follow your heart. What about, you know?
The surprising thing to me is that they always have to justify themselves.
Yeah.
I don't have to justify myself at all.
Okay, but you're in a discussion with someone who's got these intense feelings for this other person of the same sex. So you got to find a way in with them, haven't you? You can't just say I don't have to justify myself. You have to. you got to love them, Philip. You got to find your way in there somewhere.
And that's the whole crux of this whole argument, is how do we, as Christians who believe in man-woman relationships,
yes,
lovingly try and, yes, speak to a person in a situation like this,
yes,
without... I mean, we do want to be judgmental, but we cannot be judgmental.
Yes.
it's just such a difficult subject.
Yeah, it is.
Can you tell about Jesus? Yeah. How much he loves them?
I mean, you just can't. Can you?
Just tell them where love comes from. And what love, and what love is.
Yeah.
Jesus doesn't hate homosexuals.
Yeah.
It's the act of homosexuality itself.
That's right.
So.
Yeah, but you can take it back even though that it's not even homosexuality, it's just anything
sex
that deviates from God's plan. Yeah. Yeah. It's something he doesn't hate it, it's just not how it should be.
But that view in itself is, in culture anyway, is out of date, isn't it? Our view, our whole worldview, it's not just to do with homosexuality, it's sex outside of marriage. You know, our view of it being inside marriage and that alone is out of date.
Yeah.
So you're fighting that first, aren't you? It's...
But the thing is, though, it's not just about whether you say you think all sex outside of marriage is wrong. The problem people have is you saying, I believe that someone else, God, has defined how we should live. That's the actual issue.
Yeah.
People don't really care whether you think it's right or wrong. The issue is whether you say there's a designer and he has a plan for how we should be living and we should follow that plan to make us unhappy. People are like, no, you follow yourself to make us unhappy.
Well, exactly. If they don't believe in God, then you're kind of just like talking past each other, aren't you?
So in a way, you talk about God and like, well, this is who I actually believe in, who created everything, and surely that's a loving... I don't know.
But you know, it's not what we believe, it's what God says.
Yeah, but they don't believe in God.
You could take the argument back to get an agreement on other areas.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then say we agree on all of this. So if God is who he says he is, and he's given all these instructions, then you can work it out.
Yeah.
7 out of 10, you agree with
this
3
that
we need to work
with.
Yeah. But you have to do a Bible study or a course and to understand the love of God and what Jesus has done for them, as for all of us, and fall in love with Jesus instead of
the other way. I remember at the Living Out conference, weren't you?
And then once
so like, that's what the guy
him.
Said.
Mm.
He said, you can't. He said, you just have to introduce them to Jesus.
Yeah.
Mm.
Because, I mean, it's like all sinners, isn't it? In some respects, you can say, well, you know, sin is sin, and no matter what it is, and everybody needs to know the Lord, and to repent, and to follow him.
I think some people's barriers, so the hope, because the homosexuality thing is so big, isn't it?
Mm.
That's your main barrier, or that's, in their mind, is their main barrier, so any Christian... rightly or wrongly, in their view, it would be it's you're anti-gay, because it's so emotive, isn't it? I mean, that's the other thing, is that we're fighting emotion as well.
You are, yeah.
So you're, even if you're trying, you obviously you want to get them to Jesus, but you're fighting that big barrier in front of them, and it's like, well, how do you get around that?
Yeah, because they
how
don't want to know Jesus if they think
no, they're just like,
no
you're a bigot, you think it just, the barrier's up, and it's like, well, hang on a minute, you've got to get it down again, but it's...
There's really something you said to me about being sensitive to other people. So if you're sensitive to them, okay, you might not agree with it, but if you go halfway with them and maybe go to a meeting of theirs, but then say, look, I've been to listen to what your views are, why don't you come and listen to what my views are, come to one of our church meetings or something, and try and cross the barriers over and give a little, to get a little back.
Yeah. Yeah, I think in general, the kinds of things you're talking about, which you might call diversion, but I think they're just prioritising. I think it is helpful to prioritise on the love of God as seen in Jesus and getting people to realise that God is good in that sense. So I think all that stuff is really good about thinking, how can I answer in a way that says, yes, love is love, and Jesus showed that, and try and get people to put to one side, okay, let's not have an argument about homosexuality, because there's many things that you would object to that God has to say, but you need to decide whether God is good first. So I think that's having a priority of trying to get onto that firmer ground is really helpful. But there just will be times where you can't, because someone asks you a straight question and you do have to answer. And I think it's finding ways of answering that that emphasise the goodness and the love of God. So of course, yeah, there's the getting to Jesus bit, but just if you have to sort of answer the question, anything that emphasises that God is good and that God loves people, and that's why he's made the world to work in that way, and things always go best when we're following God's plan. Those kind of things, rather than just saying, yeah, God says it's wrong. Trying to get on that track, even if you then get diverted, but saying phrases like that, I think are helpful. Do you want to say any more about that? Should we talk about transgender for a few minutes? These are tough old topics. I've got less on transgender, so you're all right. Very, very straightforward in a way, very similar. Cultural context, basic idea, we can define our own gender by how we feel. Brendan O'Neill, writing in Spiked, but he also writes in The Spectator, he writes a long piece about this and says that a new and contested ideology has never been so uncritically embraced. And he's not even a Christian, but he makes the point that this is just logically crazy, what's going on with transgender, much, much more so than homosexuality, in the sense that it's completely loopy by all sort of reasonable standards. It shows how far down the rabbit hole of relativism our society has gone. I fear for the future that we will not even tell boys they are boys and girls they are girls. If teachers lack the authority even to say, you're a boy and should wear a boy's uniform, we are cultivating a new generation that will expect its every instinct to be instantly respected, and worse, that the social infrastructure from bathrooms to uniform policy should mould themselves around their instincts. So actually lots of people who are not even Christians are really, really worried. There's, I can't remember what they're called, but the female organisation. There's actually a transgender consultation going on, a government consultation. There's a website you can go on and give your views on it.
Have you given yours?
Pardon?
Have you given yours?
No, but I will do. The Evangelical Alliance answered on sort of behalf of Christians. But I mean, we could do another one as well. But what are they called? Women, something like that. Anyway, there's a women's lobby group that it started when they did a protest by changing rooms in Hampstead Heath. There's a swimming pool there, and this group of women did a massive protest against, you know, men being able to go in their changing rooms because they just self-declare as women.
Non-Christians.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a whole load of, I can't remember what they're called, they're, you know, female first, I don't know, they're called something, some sort of lobby group. So there's all that sort of stuff going on. I'm sure you've heard the phrase gender dysphoria, and it was only until very recently it was recognised as a psychological disorder. It's only very recently that it's been redefined as not a psychological disorder, but just as an identity. Gender is said to be assigned at birth, as if it was an entirely random choice, and the sort of teaching goes, and it's been completely absorbed without any contest really, but it's that it's either different or it's fluid, meaning you're allowed to say I'm in a man's body but I'm a woman. You're also allowed to say that it's fluid, that I can kind of move between, or I can be non-binary. So it's not just one thing. It's not just even a binary thing to say there's some people that are literally women inside men's bodies. It's actually to say that there's a complete fluidity across a whole kind of range to do with that. So that is, you know, if you listen to the radio a bit and you listen to kind of phone-in programs, this is completely accepted as being like legitimate. Really? What are you laughing at, Adam?
I'm sorry.
Okay. It's completely accepted as being a kind of a legitimate way of thinking. I remember there was a phone-in about a year ago, and this woman was trying to sort of painstakingly explain to the person they were phoning and they were saying, what you need to understand, you know, Sophie or whatever the girl's name is, that there's your biological gender, and then there's your gender identity. And she was like teaching this person as though it was completely accepted, well-established science, and it was like, you know, teaching someone some basic thing, you know, about, well, you know, you I don't know, something really simple, like mathematics or something. But that is pretty much accepted.
Didn't that just create more confusion?
Well, it does.
Not even thinking about that.
Yeah. As it says on the handout there, 80% of children, 1, 2, 3, 4, fourth bullet point under cultural context, 80% of children who were referred for gender dysphoria before adolescence return to identifying with their birth gender in adulthood. So in 80% of cases, they either go through with something but regret it, or they just change their mind. It's considered a sort of a phase that some children go through, which rather than being embraced, should not be particularly sort of punished, but should be just kind of accepted but discouraged, as being the beginning of discovering a different identity. So, you know, because we love people, we want to create a church culture that does that. That accepts that teenagers may go through that and loves them through that, but doesn't affirm it, because that's not the loving thing to do. Yes?
There's this one, ain't there, in this group?
Transvestite. Yeah, it's transgender is used as a catch-all term, including everything, but not intersex. So transgender uses some of the language of intersex. Intersex, where you've got a chromosome disorder, where you've got maybe both genitalia or not properly formed genitalia or something like that. But yeah, transgender nowadays includes both transvestite is dressing up as the other sex, just dressing up as the other sex. And that can be right through to having surgery to change the sort of sexual organs. So transgender is a general term for all of those things, from dressing up through to a sort of a more kind of lifestyle, complete identification as the other gender, through to having surgery to make your life injured. It's a sort of umbrella term for all of those things, if that makes sense. Next bullet point there says, basically, people who present with gender dysphoria, generally speaking, have nearly always have loads of other psychological disorders. It's like a friend of, or an enemy of, other psychological disorders, mood disorders, anxiety, suicidality, if that's the word.
Isn't that just exactly what you read in the Bible now?
Yeah.
Where God put them over to their depraved mind.
Yes.
Now their depraved mind is fighting back.
Sure.
Probably saying, hey, you need to go back to what God created you to be.
Yeah. And I think most Christians who kind of write on the subject would say that in most cases, transgenderism is not as simple as even a psychological problem that you think you're a male or female. It's probably a confused same-sex attraction that's just played out in a slightly different way. So it is strongly connected with same-sex attraction as well. Okay. So how would you talk to anybody? What would you say to anybody? Yeah.
As a homosexual thing, because like, well, it's not natural. Like, it's like obvious.
Well, with the LGBT community, they lump it all in together, don't they? So like, it's like if you are, so if you're opposed to one, you're opposed to all. Mm-hmm. Being a Christian would be. That just means then, like, you can't.
But because it's the transgender, they're like attached to the LGBT.
But
like
I think society, though, is not as comfortable with it as they are with homosexuality.
Yeah, exactly.
So a lot of people, I suppose, are confused that
It's more the fear of a lot, like you were saying, a lot of people actually do think it's not right, but because it is attached to homosexuality, it's that fear of standing out against it is so great that and the weird culture of today that's almost become like cool like that, like it's kind of like fashionable to be like that, I think.
Yeah, I think there's also this fear, not fear, you have some sympathy, you know, this poor lad is trapped.
Yes.
In a woman's body or vice versa. That must be awful, mustn't it, if you feel like that. You're not necessarily engaged in a homosexual act, but it's something inside you.
Yeah.
And also, I mean, going back on both occasions, if you look at it, the secular world embraces homosexual marriage, it embraces transgenderism, gay pride, even the Queen's cousin just got remarried to a bloke.
Right.
And it's put in the newspapers as being normal.
Yeah.
Elton John is married and they've got two little boys, you know.
Yeah. I think to do with transgender, though, I think... Actually, what you said as you began, I think it's quite reasonable to say that must feel horrible to someone. I think that's quite a reasonable thing for a Christian to say to a person who's sensing that. To say, you know, I really, you know, care about the way you're feeling, but this is a distortion of reality. It's actually true to do with homosexuality that's a distortion of reality, because in reality, you're a bloke or a woman made to have sex with the opposite sex. So that's a distortion of reality. I just think it's a much easier argument to do with transgender, that it's so obviously a distortion of reality. It's like so untrue that, and it's actually because we love the bodies that God has given us, that's why we want people to act out the gender that they've been given. So it's a love thing to say, we want to try and love you by helping you to be comfortable with the body that you've got. You may want to get more fit or whatever, or you know, cut your hair, but be comfortable generally with the body that you've got, as in the gender that you've got. So I think that, as Andy said, I think the denial of truth, everyone kind of knows it's illogical, and also I think it resonates with people that this is damaging to children. I think it's quite reasonable to make the natural law argument, not the biblical argument, that just says this is so damaging to children to encourage them to do this because at least 80% in studies change their minds. So you're condemning 80% of children to a miserable existence because they've made a mistake. There's actually a bigger percentage if you go for people who are in older age, have had the operation and then want to go back. But there's no statistics kind of published about that. Anyway, so I think making an argument is a powerful one to say this hurts children. This really damages children. We love children. This is unfair on children. This is not good parenting. I think making those arguments really passionately because it's just awful. I think making the arguments about protection, you know... most of the male prisoners who then identify as women to get into women prisons, the vast majority are sexual offenders. It's statistically a fact, and often offend again. And because of the narratives, that's mostly suppressed. But it was on a BBC report recently. But if you unravelled it and looked at the original statistics, that was so. So I think it's reasonable to make that argument about. The kind of safety argument to say this is damaging to children, this is actually unsafe for women, and it's actually a women's rights issue that says if we continue down this road and there's no distinction, there are actually no rights other than to do what you want to do. There are no men's rights, there are no women's rights left, because it's completely been flattened. And I think kind of thinkers are realising that, and I suppose a highlight of that is the changing room issue, because that's where it becomes really obvious, or the prison issue, that you know, if you self-identify and you go into the female changing room, that's clearly the woman now has lost the right to privacy, they've lost the right to protection, the discretion, all those things have been lost, all those kind of rights have been lost. There is no such thing as women's rights anymore if you follow this logic conclusion, or men's rights either. Yes.
Biologically,
yeah.
Male, female.
Yeah.
So this self-identifying thing is just ridiculous. You should be told you're male.
Yeah.
And you're female.
Yeah. But to a lot of people are saying, you know, we really understand how that feels and all the causes of that, but getting them to embrace it. But embracing it doesn't mean they stop liking sewing or whatever. It means I think you want to live in a culture where you dress as the culture dresses, but there's quite a lot of latitude in that. So I think you want to dress as the gender generally that you are. But I mean, in our culture, there's loads of latitude for that. It's not as though you want to say every feminine characteristic means you must be a female. I think that's the dangerous thing. You know, if you're sort of sensitive and caring, that must mean you're either sort of gay or you should, you know, transgender into another gender. It doesn't mean that. It just means you happen to be a bit more sensitive and caring than some other people are. And all those things.
These people have such an objection to Christianity when, if they, like, it is the answer, and it must be so freeing.
Yes.
To go from that to then being Christian, because, you know, God talks a lot about, Jesus talks a lot about, like, the heart and, you know, I guess, people, like, what you are on the inside and, like, all that doesn't matter. And it's like, if someone truly could grasp that, and you should be comfortable in who you are, and, like, God sees your struggles and he's with you through all of that and all that, and it's completely, it must be completely freeing from having to, for being told that everything that you are feeling inside, you have to express as
that. There must be examples.
Yeah.
You can point to people and say that, look at how this person accepted Christ. They've got all the same issues that you're showing, but look at the outcomes. Is that not something you want to?
Yeah.
So
Amazon, the
Bible also says that we people turn away from the light because they enjoy living in the dark. And so there is that sense of wanting to reject, you know, the right way, the good way, because they need the way.
Part of the contentment with that. Let's pray and then we'll stop.